So tonight we're going to start a new chapter in our study of the Mussar movement. And this chapter, you'll see on the top right, on the right side, which is not the page that we're going to be studying tonight, but you'll see Rabbi Nosson Tzvi Finkel. That's the name of this giant in the Mussar movement. But if you met a person on the street who learned in yeshiva, and you said Rabbi Nosson Tzvi Finkel, he would think that you're referring to the late Rosh Yeshiva, the Mir Yeshiva, who just passed away a few years ago. But we're going back about 100 years into time. The Rosh Yeshiva, the Mir, was named after this original Rabbi Nosson Tzvi Finkel. And in the yeshiva world, he's known as the Altar of Slabodka. So if you could jot that down on the side of your page, because again, this whole book is dedicated to him, and we're starting on page 115. The reason is because in the past you were not interested in stories and history and biology, biography, but rather in the methodology. So that's why we're skipping 114 pages. But of course, if you're interested, I would encourage you to read those 114 pages if you have about an hour tonight. So the Altar von Slabodka. Now, to understand the generations here, the first generation would be what? Or whom?
Simcha Zisl?
No, that's the second generation. But who comes before of Simcha Zisl? Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is the Rebbe. He's the teacher. He establishes the Mussar movement. One of his, let's say, top two or three students, disciples, is the Altar of Kelm. And we spent a lot of time studying the methodology of the Altar of Kelm. His name was Simcha Zisl. Okay. And just to review just really the nitty-gritty basics, he created an institution called Beis HaTalmud. And Beis HaTalmud was a very unique place. It was secluded, it was very quiet. You had to live by a certain regimen. Everything was disciplined. You had to get up at a certain time. You had to go to sleep at a certain time. You had to learn at a certain time. And the philosophy of the Beis HaTalmud, of the Altar of Kelm, was predicated on the assumption that every Jew is equal. We're all created equal. In fact, his yeshiva students would clean the floors. They didn't have a professional cleaning, a cleaning company come in and clean the floors. And everyone had to participate in that activity. So that's the philosophy of what we call shiflus ha'adam. Man is a lowly being. Man is mortal. He's here today and gone tomorrow. Not the greatness of man, but rather the lowliness of man. Man has great potential, but he, so to speak, has to build up from the bottom. And again, within this atmosphere, this almost oppressive atmosphere of regiment, of discipline, discipline became like super, capital D. That was primary, to make sure that everything was done and everything was implemented exactly in its time. You know, you're like in a little bit of a box. Now, we're up to the third generation. The third generation takes us to the end of the 19th century. Shall we say the last 10 years or so of the 19th century, 1890, and brings us into the 20th century. And the head of this particular branch of the Mussar movement is Rabbi Nosson Tzvi Finkel, otherwise known as the Altar of Slabodka. Now, there are many pictures of him in the book. In your page 117, you'll see one picture. He wore cool glasses 120 years ago. And although maybe this picture doesn't convey it, he was a pretty cool guy. And when I say this, what I mean is, not only did he command respect, as all his predecessors did in the Musa movement. But above and beyond that, they looked up to him as a friend. They looked up to him as a leader. Imagine if you had a group of friends and one of them was outstanding in all ways. And everybody looks up to him, but they feel close to him. He molded the lives of thousands of students. Even though he wasn't the Rosh Yeshiva, he wasn't the head of the yeshiva, at all times the yeshiva in that city in Lithuania called Slabodka had a Rosh Yeshiva. It had great Rosh Yeshiva, outstanding and famous ones, but nevertheless, the one individual who left the most indelible, profound impact on the students was none other than the Mashkiach, Rav Nosson Nota Finkel, who was Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, the altar of Slabodka. There's a nicer picture of him here on page 16, which you don't have. I'll just show and tell over here. And that's what he looked at like with the cool glasses. Everyone claimed him for their own. He was such a charismatic personality that everyone said, well, I was the choice student. He loved me the most. And there were so many people who claimed to be that choice student. The city of Slabodka is a twin city to another city called Kovna. And during the Holocaust, untold numbers of Jews perished in Kovna, Slabodka. They brought all the Jews from Slabodka over to Kovna, and that's where they decimated them. The Lithuanians themselves, the non-Jews, played a major role in rounding up the Jews. It wasn't just the Nazis. The Nazis actually murdered the Jews. Now, my father, may rest in peace, had friends who went to learn in the Yeshiva Slabodka. Some of them were able to get out because they had American passports before the Nazis came in. Others perished. In fact, one of those students was able to come back to the United States, and all of his friends got together and made a party for him. And at that party, my father met my mother. Yeah. Wow. So that was a party for someone. No, I think I made a mistake. He was going off to Slabodka. Not on his way back, but when he was going off to Slabodka. My father himself did not learn in the city of Slabodka and in the yeshiva of the altar, but he had many friends who did. Now, if you're into the who's who list in heads of yeshiva and Rosh Yeshiva, and which of them studied under the altar of Slabodka, I'll just mention a few in passing. Maybe you've heard of them. One of them was the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin Yeshiva, a major yeshiva in Brooklyn, New York. His name was Rav Yitzchak Huttner. Another Talmud of the altar, also very famous. He was in a different yeshiva in Brooklyn, New York, called Torah V'Das. His name was Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Again, I don't know if you've heard of him.
I've heard of Kamenetsky.
I'm from Brooklyn, so all these yeshivas are
right. Right. And then a third name that I would mention, maybe you heard of a yeshiva in Lakewood, New Jersey, that's called Rav Aaron Cutler. So these are all famous names in the yeshiva, in the history of yeshivas in America. All these individuals molded the yeshiva world in America. And they were all students of the altar of Slabodka. He had a tremendous impact on them. Now, what...
Yeah. Chevron, right?
Oh.
We saw it, actually. Some of us went to Chevron. We saw the old building. They pointed it out to us. And it was like the mirror of its day, right. Basically, right?
Right.
Yeah.
In the year 1929, when Rav Nosson Tzvi sent his students to Israel from Slabodka to Palestine, and they learned and established a yeshiva in Hebron, the old city of Hebron, the Arabs rioted and they murdered tens of yeshiva students. Many were injured as well. There's a woman who came to my class last night, an elderly woman. Her father was injured in that attack, in that Arab riot.
Is that in 29?
I think it was 1929. Tarpat is in Hebrew, it's called.
Oh, yeah, the massacre of 29 in Hebron, right. Yeah.
Now, Rav Nosson Tzvi himself at that point was still back in Slabodka, and he did not suffer personally the death, but many of his Talmidim were killed, were murdered. Other of his Talmidim, as we said before, came to America. They emigrated to America and they became the heads of the most powerful yeshivot in America. I don't know if you've heard of a yeshiva called Ner Yisrael in Baltimore. The Rosh Yeshiva's name was Rav Yaakov Ruderman. Again, these are famous names in the yeshiva world. To you, they don't mean much, but trust me, I mean, this is, if you're collecting baseball cards, you know, in my day, this would be like Sandy Koufax and Mickey Mantle, you know. I was a big fan of the Mets, so I like Ron Hunt. But anyway, so these guys are all on the baseball cards. You know, these are the big giants. Rav Ruderman established in his time a yeshiva in Houghton. First it was in Connecticut, and then it moved to Baltimore, and it's still a very, very vibrant yeshiva today. And this Rosh Yeshiva who established the yeshiva, Rav Ruderman, was again a Talmud of the Alta Slabodka. So you know that there's an organization of very pious Jews called the Aguda. Have you heard of it? Aguda? So the Aguda, when they had conventions, these rabbis, who all knew each other because they studied in the same yeshiva, they ran the show. Now, as we said before, Rav Nosson Tzvi was the third generation from Rav Salanter. So in effect, he should have been a student of Rav Simcha Zissel. What was the relationship between the altar of Slabodka and the altar of Kovna, and the altar of Kelm, Rav Simcha Zissel? The first half of the chapter that you have in front of you is dedicated to answer this question. And the answer is quite paradoxical and complex. On the one hand, Rav Nosson Tzvi is accredited in the history of the Musav movement with the link between Rav Simcha Zissel and the next generation, as if to say that he was the carrier, you know, he carried the baton further and basically expanded the methodology of Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelm. But that's anything but true. Although Rav Nosson Tzvi had a tremendous awe and respect for the altar of Kelm, he thought in many ways that his approach towards Musar was no longer viable. It may have been viable for that generation, but not for his generation. Rav Nosson Tzvi was a very original thinker. He had a tremendously powerful sense of critique, of criticism. And he put everything under that, you know, that critique. He would analyze everything. Any idea that he heard, he had to put it into his laboratory and check it out. And very often it happened that he did not accept those principles of Musar and the methodology of his Rebbe, the Altar of Kelm. In fact, it was quite known, quite famous in the Musar movement, that there were controversies between the Rebbe and the Talmud, between the Altar of Kelm and the Altar of Slabodka. Now, if you could follow me in the Hebrew, we're on line 4 of the text itself. And again, I always say the following. I'm going to read the text for those who follow it and then translate it into English. Yodua, it's well known, Shesharu Beinehem, there was between them, Lefa'amim, on many occasions, Chiluke Deot, controversies, different views, different vantage points, Bashkafot Mesuyamot, with regard to basic issues. And as a result, Rav Nosson Tzvi, in Slabodka, established a brand new approach to the Musar movement, to the methodology and the teachings of Musar. And his new methodology was to some extent absolutely antithetical to that of his Rebbe, Rav Simcha Zissel. So when you talk about the history of the Musar movement, don't get the misimpression that it was Rebbe, Talmud, it was a long train of tradition and everyone was just carrying the baton of what they heard from the previous generation. That's not true. Each giant in the history of Musa brought to the table his own particular hashkafot, his own perspectives, and the most profound difference, a very sharp difference, is between that of Rav Simcha Zissel in Kelm and that of the Altar of Slabodka. If you look at the city of Kelm from the perspective of Musar, it's kind of a passive city. Yeshiva students who learned in Kelm, and for that matter, almost the complexion of the whole city of Kelm, because of that powerful influence of Rav Simcha Zissel, is one of passivity. The Jews were very passive, with a tremendous amount of faith and belief, with a tremendous self-control and discipline, as we said over and over again. But the idea of creativity, of originality, of breaking out of the fetters and being different, being, if you will, original and cool, that was not typical of the city of Kelm. But it was very much in vogue in the city of Slabodka because of the influence and the impact of the altar. Man was made as an original thinker. He was created by God with an image and an intellect that was dedicated, meant to be dedicated to creativity, to original thinking. Man is great. So that whereas the Kelmer saw each man as sort of equal, in a box, very disciplined, very perfect, very much full of the awe of the Almighty, the altar of Slabodka created a different spirit to the Musar movement. Now, I mentioned I apologize, you know, if you weren't here when I mentioned that Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, my Rebbe's grandfather, was very much opposed to the Musar movement. He did not allow them to enter into his yeshiva in the city of Brisk. Now, Brisk is located in Lita. It's one of the most major, if not the major, citadel of Torah, and not to let the Musar movement come in. So my Rebbe told us that the reason for that was because Reb Chaim was opposed to this concept of man being passive, of man being downtrodden, of man looking at himself v'shiflus, with that ultimate humility and the feeling of worthlessness. That was so opposed and antithetical to the approach of Reb Chaim, because Reb Chaim was the creative thinker. My Rebbe told us that Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, knew not only Torah, he knew philosophy. He would walk with philosophy professors, you know, take a walk in the forest, that he would challenge them. Everything was about being creative and being a genius. My Rebbe would never say the same thing twice. He was like allergic to it. I remember once we were sitting in class, and Rav Soloveitchik was stuck on a sugi, he couldn't figure it out. So my friend Rabbi Ilse raised his hand, and he said, Rebbe, I remember what you said on this 5 years ago. So Rav Soloveitchik took his hand, slammed it on the table, and he said, you forget what I said 5 years ago. You listen to what I say now. And one of the greats at Yeshiva University, Rav Moshe Tendler Shlita, he says that he learned Chulin, a certain Masechet and Shas, twice with Rav Soloveitchik, and he never heard the same Torah twice. There was an obsession with creativity. And why do I mention this to you? Because Rav Soloveitchik told us that had Rav Chaim had to decide about Musar in the next period, had Rav Chaim been alive at the time of the Slabodka Musar movement of the altar, he would have allowed Musar into the yeshiva, because the spirit and the methodology of the altar was much more in line with Reb Chaim Brisker, the idea that each individual is endowed with his own unique creativity and originality, and the altar of Slabodka was the most original. He was an original thinker, both in terms of theory and methodology, in the whole history of the Musar movement. So that's why when I talk about the altar, you have to understand, I get very excited. I'm very thrilled, because, you know, I understand the impact that he had on his students, because some of these students were role models in my life and continue to be role models even after their death, because we continue to study their writings. And we see endlessly, over and over, how much they were influenced by this powerful personality called Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, the altar of Slabodka.
We just studied like as a group, because yeah, I remember we talked about Resh Lakish, but also Chia, Rav Chia, and basically that, you know, he wanted to have Torah like be accessible, and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did, kind of wanted it more maybe
selective. You mean?
Yeah, yeah. It seems like the, it's a similar type of like Hashkafik or like machlofit, kind of like that just repeats itself, like an idea.
Right. Like, you can talk about the history of Hasidut versus those who opposed Hasidut.
Right.
It's exoteric and esoteric.
Right.
Now, let's get back to our original question. What is the relationship between the altar of Slabodka and the altar of Kelm, the previous generation? First of all, what we have to know is that despite their differences of opinion, there was a tremendous admiration, one for the other. And in this book that we're reading called Tenuat HaMusar from Rav Katz, he takes an entire section to republish, word for word, the writings of Rav Nosson Tzvi, the altar of Slabodka, when he was called upon to write an introduction before they published the writings of Rav Simcha Zissel. Because again, he's considered the third link in the chain of the Musa movement, and it made natural sense to turn to him to write the introduction to this book. So what happened is Rav Simcha Zissel was gone, and after his death, they got a hold of some of his writings, and some of the students had written notes of his lectures, and they wanted to publish it, but they needed someone to write an introduction to the book. So they called upon Rav Nosson Tzvi, the altar of Slabodka, to write the introduction. And it's called, if you take a look on this page, 115, three lines before the end of the page, he says, Pticha, an introduction, l'sefer, to a book called Kitvei Rav Simcha Zissel, the writings of Rav Simcha Zissel. Shehuchan l'persum, they were ready for publication. So everything was set, they were going to go to print, except they needed an introduction. So Rav Nosson Tzvi responded to this request by writing an igeres. He wrote a letter. And the truth is, we have virtually nothing in writing from Rav Nosson Tzvi. All the Torah that we know from Rav Nosson Tzvi was passed on orally as a tradition. He was not known as a writer. But this igeres is one of the only writings that he left after he died. So it's fascinating to see his style of writing. Because a lot of people think, well, the altar never published anything, he probably didn't know how to write. Yeah. But the writing that we do have from him really indicates that he was an absolute genius and a poet, and he had an amazing command of the Hebrew language. So this letter, which is written by Rav Nosson Tzvi, by the altar of Slabodka, is copied on pages 116 and 118, word for word. It ends on page 118, right before the fourth paragraph, called Ulam. You may see that the last word is La'ar, if you happen to see, you know, then there were, you know, end quotes. So this is a long letter, and we don't have the time now to read through the entire letter, but just to call your attention to some of the highlights. In the first paragraph, which is on the top of page 116, he gives praise with love and respect for the entire group of students of Rav Simcha Zissel from the Beis HaTalmud of Kelm, that great institution in which they raise the banner of Torah and Tefillah. So on the second line, you might want to underline the words Torah u'tfilah, because this is very unique. In the writings of our rabbis, we have two distinct categories. We have a Beit HaMidrash and a Beit HaKnesset. Can anybody tell me the difference between the two? What do we dedicate ourselves to in a Beit Midrash? And what do we dedicate ourselves to in a Beit HaKnesset?
One is studying, one is prayer.
Correct. In the case of a Beit Midrash, we raise the banner of Torah study. In the case of Beit HaKnesset, it's tefillah, it's prayer. The altar of Slabodka is telling us that in the Beis HaTalmud in Kelm, there was an absolute integration of both. So the Beis HaTalmud was a place where you went in to learn how to learn, to study Torah, and to learn how to pray to Hashem. He goes on to say that I received a letter from you with the great news that you've gone into the hidden writings, the manuscripts of the altar of Kelm and other writings of his students, and you were about to reveal them by publishing them and giving it access to the wider public. And I'm absolutely thrilled about that. And he speaks about the manuscripts of, and this is on line 4, Adonenu Morenu Meorenu, our master, our teacher, our light, Harav Hagon, the genius, Achasid, the pious one, Rav Simcha Zissel, Zichrono Levrach, may rest in peace. And who was this great master and teacher, the light, the luminary of the world? He was the one who opened our eyes to the ways of the Torah. In other words, how to find the pathways to Torah. And he praises this effort to publish the manuscripts of Reb Simcha Zissel. That's paragraph number one. In paragraph number two, he turns to the to respond to the one who asked him for the letter of introduction. And he says to him that he should be blessed with oz. Oz means strength. And with simcha, with joy. Because he's making it possible, he's giving an opportunity for those who are mishtokikim, who have a tremendous craving and misgagim and longing for this work that you're about to publish. There's people are waiting with bated breath for this book to come out, because this book will educate the masses in the methodology of the great Reb Simcha Zissel, for those who understand truth. And clearly, Reb Nosson Tzvi is indicating that the truth of Torah and its methodology is incorporated in the manuscripts and the writings of Reb Simcha Zissel. Then, in the third paragraph, he goes on to say that my parents, may they rest in peace, from the time that they raised me to stand on my own feet, they taught me to have love and awe for the God, for the genius. And again, he goes through Adonenu, Morenu, Verabenu, referring to the altar of Kelm. And my shimush, meaning my service, now let me point out that the word service doesn't mean to pour someone a cup of tea in this context. Here the word service means when you get to know someone and learn from them by watching the way they behave. That's called shimush talmidei chachamim. And he says that when I served the great master, etc., Rav Simcha Zissel, I saw an olam hafuch. I saw a world which was the exact opposite. It was like topsy-turvy. It's like turning someone from his feet to stand on his head. That's what I saw with my weak eyes. He's implying here in this poetic presentation that when he came to the yeshiva at Beis HaTalmud, Rav Nosson Tzvi didn't understand what was going on. Again, if you remember our descriptions, it was set into a private area. You know, you had to go through the doors, and when you came in, you know, there was absolute silence, and everything was according to a certain regimen. It was like entering into an army base, and everything seemed to me to be upside down and topsy turvy. It was exactly antithetical to what I thought a yeshiva should be. However, after years of spending in the yeshiva, I began to appreciate only a little of what this is all about, of the Derech HaSeichel. You may remember that Reb Simcha Zissel put all the emphasis on the intellect, that the intellect should control the emotions. Again, I'm not reviewing everything we said over the course of weeks. But he says, when he first started in the yeshiva, lo zarach alai or ha-Torah ha-mitis. I didn't see the light of Torah, the true light of Torah. And instead, hichlafti emes b'sheker. I thought that the emes, the truth, was really false. Vatov bara, and what I was looking at, which was really good, I thought of it as being evil. He's implying that he rebelled against the system of the Beis HaTalmud. It's a fantastic statement here. Because on the one hand, he's telling you that the real emes, the real truth, the real good, ultimate, is in Rav Simcha Zissel. But I, as a student, perceived it in a very... doubts about something, what's the word?
Skeptical.
Skeptical, excellent. Thank you so much, Jackie. I was very skeptical, he admits, about the whole system. But us, and this is in the paragraph Anochi, line 6, the word us is the turning point. At some point, hisponanti, I began to contemplate. And I realized that this man, Dugal Mirvava, he's on the highest level. He's not a human being. Rather, he has the spirit of God in him. He really like belongs to the world of celestial beings.
Is he like a Dvekus a little bit?
I wouldn't say Dvekus, but he began to appreciate who Rav Simcha Zissel was. For the first couple of years, it sounds like he thought he was a bad guy. He was evil. He was false. But it took him years, and during his maturity, to process the fact that Rav Simcha Zissel was a gadol, was great, and just that we didn't have the ability lehitamek to go deep enough to remove the outer layers of Rav Simcha Zissel's Torah and realize what was below the surface, that there was a great godly divine spirit in all of his ways, that he was a Mayon HaMizgaber, that Rav Simcha Zissel was like a spring that never stops giving water, whether it's in halacha, whether it's in pilpul, meaning the didactics of Torah, whether it's in Musar. And finally, when I matured, I realized, I came to the point in which Herich Marachos Gedolos, I began to appreciate those great movements of this Gadol, of the Ruach Hashem, the Spirit of God that moved him. And how original his approach was, and how important it was. But again, keep in mind that two things are happening in this letter of introduction. One is an expression of awe and a recognition of the greatness of Rav Simcha Zissel. But at the same time, if you read between the lines, and you don't have to work very hard to do so, an implication that the approach and the method of Beis HaTalmud of Kelm or Rav Simcha Zissel was something that, at least on a natural basis, irritated the Alter of Slavot. He couldn't fit into it. He couldn't accept it. And now to finish up the letter on page 118, he writes that the greatest giant of Torah of that generation, the Chatam Sofer, writes about the altar of Kelm that Karabo Kol Yimei Chayav, that anything he could get a hold of, the Chasam Sofer, that was attributed to Rav Simcha Zissel, he would read it over and over again during the course of his lifetime. And now he signs off Rav Nosson Tzvi on this introduction, and he blesses them, Chizku, you should be strong. You will get rewarded for everything that you publish, for all the Torah that you popularize. And you are taking the Torah out of a tree, so to speak, from a... He's comparing Rav Simcha Zissel to a great tree. And he writes, as a result, this tree is going to give forth fruit that's going to satiate the knowledge and the mind of the students of Musar. And then he signs off in the paragraph that starts Eila. Now, after Rabbi Katz, the author of this book, quotes this letter of the Alta Slavotka, letter word for word, and it's all the Alta's own writing, he writes, Ulam. Ulam means however. Together with all the admiration that Rav Nosson Tzvi expresses in this letter, you should know that he had a different approach, a radically different methodology of Musar. He calls it Shita Acheret Me'asher Abo. He deviated from the methodology of his Rebbe, and who gam shoneh me'adrachim ha'makubalot shel kol rabanei ha'musar b'shato. Rav Nosson Tzvi's approach, his method in Musar, was radically different than all the other giants and teachers and leaders of the Musar movement at that particular period of time. So who becomes the rebellious one? Who becomes the one who says, I have a dream? It's Rav Nosson Tzvi. And he parts ways with all of the other greats of Musar. And that's why I chose to study this with you. Because Rav Nosson's methodology, the altar of Slobodka, was revolutionary. Now there are four words here which I want you to underline. I think in one of your copies, maybe it's already underlined because I was using that copy to prepare. And that's on the second line of the paragraph that starts Hanukuda, and he says, "Hi gishato laharachat adam." So you must underline those four words. Let's translate them. He's trying to formulate an answer to the following question: what was the revolution of Rav Nosson Tzvi? And the answer is his approach to evaluating man. How do you evaluate man? Classically, in the Musar approach, man was seen as a low being. Man was lowly. He was mortal, physical, overwhelmed by the Yetzer Hara, by the evil inclination. If we go back to the Parsha of the Marble, man was created evil from the time, he has an evil inclination from the time that he's born. And man has to really climb through a lifetime of hard work to, so to speak, to pull himself up by the bootstraps from the lowly nature of man. And that's what Rav Katz writes in the next paragraph, Hashita Musarit. And he says the following, that the approach of Musar that is expressed by most Musar Sfarim, the books of Musar that were accepted at that time by those who educated and transmitted the Musar approach, was to prove and to reveal the, now here's the key word at the end of the second line in this paragraph, Afsuto. Afsuto comes from the word Ephes. What does Ephes mean?
Zero.
The zeroness of man. Prisus erko, the low valuation of man. Man is completely controlled by his evil inclination. And all of his life should be dedicated to a very harsh, keen awareness of the evil inclination within him in order to struggle and fight against this force of evil and raise himself up. And for the balance of this paragraph, in very poetic terms, Rav Dov Katz describes the classic approach of Musar, in which the fundamental principle of the philosophy of Musar is that man, by definition, is self-centered. He thinks that he's the epicenter of the universe. And therefore the Musar is meant to break man's arrogance. Because man thinks that he can dedicate himself to fulfill his aspirations in life and to make sure that he fulfills his taivos, his pleasures, his lusts, and his interests. And that's why the Torah warns us, V'ram levavcha, if your heart is too high, meaning you think too highly of yourself, the Torah warns that as a result, V'shachatot Hashem al-Kefa, you have no room for God. You make yourself into God. And to break that arrogance of man, we have the Musar movement. Because when man refuses to carry the burden of Torah and all its requirements, it's because he's self-centered. He thinks he knows better. He is great. And he is going to legislate the laws for himself. Now, as a result of this approach to Musar, the writers and the teachers of Musar constantly compared man to Hevel, as in the spirit of Koheles, you know, the writings of Shlomo HaMelech, where man is vain and his life is vanity. Yesodo me'ofar, man comes from the dust. V'sofo li'ofar, and he goes back to the dust. He's created from a tipa srucha, that's the, you know, the egg that's impregnated with the sperm. It's karetz mi'chomer, it's physical, achur. It's really disgusting. And man's life could be compared to a tzitz no veil, tzel no veil. He's like a passing shadow. He's like a budding flower that withers up and dies. And he ends up on the top of page 119 with the worms crawl in and the worms crawl out. This is what man is all about. And the goal of Musar is tashpil es rucho, to lower the spirit of man, break his spirit. He has a spirit that's too high. He thinks too highly of himself. We have to break that down. We have to undermine that. Lachnio. Lachnio means to subjugate him. So that he accepts Morus. Morus means the authority of his creator. We have to break his Yetzer. Everything is about negativity. This is the classic Musar approach in Kelm and beyond. Until, in the second paragraph, we get Rav Nosson Tzvi, who begins to question whether this is the right approach in his generation. It may have worked for previous generations, because in previous generations, man thought very highly of himself. And especially the yeshiva person who would study the Torah, he had a ruach aza, a very powerful self-image or spirit. And therefore, to some extent, like the Tower of Babel, he wanted to challenge God because he's so great, thinking so highly of himself. And therefore, we have to break him. And that approach was very appropriate for that generation. To break the gaiva, the self-centered conceit of man. Lachnias rucho. However, aval, on line 4, in our generations, we have a totally different phenomenon, a totally different description of man. Man is no longer up on top, thinking of himself very highly. On the contrary, his ruach is nich'eh, inside of him. His spirit is low. And as a result, he feels like he's valueless. He's meaningless. By the way, I'll just point out in case you're interested as a footnote here, at the time of Slabodka, or up until the time of Slabodka, the girls didn't want to marry the boys. In fact, in some yeshivas, men couldn't get married till they were way into the 40s. They just couldn't find women who would be willing to marry them. That's how bad their self-image was. They considered the yeshiva bacha to be and people even today are very cynical. You know, oh, they're a bunch of bench warmers. You know, they just sit and warm the bench. You know, they sit and fetch the benkel. You know, they learn Torah. And they're parasites and they don't contribute anything. The image of the yeshiva bacha became a very low image. And as a result, the whole generation was on the line of in jeopardy. How would you say it? It was a slippery slope. You meaning they came very close, the yeshiva bacha, to losing so much heart in themselves that they would just possibly break it and just reject it all. That's the psychological power of the lowliness in the image of the yeshiva student at that time. They didn't have respect. He says Chavuyash Sakara Gdola B'shita Tashpalat Erkom. Rav Nosson Tzvi recognized the danger involved in breaking the spirit of the yeshiva bacha. It may lower his spirit completely. He'll have a negative self-image. He'll suffer from an inferiority complex. And ultimately, that's not going to do him any good. And therefore, the next paragraph, in the light of this thought, of this analysis, Rav Nosson Tzvi decided to change the methodology. A revolution, as we said, of major proportions. Instead of pointing out how lowly man is, how mortal, flesh and blood, full of desires, he comes from the ground and he goes back to the ground, the Yetzer Hara takes over him. No, let's reveal a different dimension of man and his nature. Let's talk about his spirituality. Let's talk about the fact that he's a divine being. He has been created in the image of God. Let's talk about the fact that in his body he has a neshama, a soul that comes from the hidden parts of the upper spheres. Let's talk about the fact that man is divine and godly. He's part of God. He is the ultimate goal of creation. Nothing that God created was not, oh, that's a double negative, but let me say in the positive, everything that God created was created for him. And this is a Mishnah in Masechta Sanhedrin, you'll see in footnote number two. We have to get the yeshiva student to recognize the fact that in his very roots, inside of him, is Romamus HaNefesh, is the highest level of the soul. Tenaseu El Al, a soul that just uplifts him up to the heavens. Man is angelic. And here Rav Nosson Tzvi would quote a verse in the Bible, in the Tanakh, Vatechasreyu Ma'at Melokim. Man was created a little bit less than God. That's how great man is. This recognition will motivate him not only to think highly of himself, but to set high goals for himself. His purpose in life now becomes very high, very, very lofty, because he understands how great he is. Instead of preaching the lowliness of man, teach the greatness of man. And as a result, you'll be able to plant in man all sorts of my English tonight is not good, she'ifot, are aspirations. Very, very high aspirations. You know, if a person thinks lowly of himself, then, you know, he's hoping he'll pass the exam. He'll get a 70 on the exam. But if a person thinks highly of himself, then on his level, he should not get a 70 or an 80. He should get a 100 or a 99. In other words, the greater you are in terms of your own self-image, the greater your aspirations are, your goals. You set very high goals for yourself. If man is lowly, then why should he set high goals for himself? You know, you're applying to a graduate school, you know, go apply to City College. Why should you apply to, you know, to the Ivy Leagues? Because I'm dumb anyway, you know, so who am I? But if I tell you and I preach to you and I raise you to believe in yourself, then you could have greater aspirations. And therefore, to achieve this goal, on the bottom paragraph of 119, that man should always have a positive self-image, Reb Nosson would establish for himself an educational program, the goal of which, and every single speech he gave, was to talk about man. Original man. Who is original man?
Adam HaRishon.
The creation of man. Who was Adam HaRishon? Again, later he sinned. But who was he in his original creative form? He was on the highest level. He was the handiwork of the Almighty. He was completely dedicated to spiritual pleasures on the highest level. He had unbelievable potential. According to our rabbis, the angels came down from heaven and they wanted to bow down to man because they thought man was God. And as a result, man had great aspirations. Chatar, three lines up from the bottom of the page, Lahalot et Madrigosam Ha'ishis. Now Rav Nosson Tzvi is going to tell man who he is. We are descendants of the first man that was created by God with his hand, namely Adam. We also have to understand that we have within us Madregos Gedolos, Hasagos Elyonos. We have unbelievably high levels, and we can aspire to great achievements, whether it's in Torah, whether it's in the perfection of our nefesh. And here we're turning to page 120. Rav Nosson Tzvi, with his lectures, was able to arouse the people, to shake them up, lizazeah, to bring them to the point at which they could recognize and acknowledge their greatness. As a result, Rav Nosson Tzvi was able to break a negative trait called histapkus. Histapkus means to be complacent, to be happy with where I am. As we said before, if I can pass the exam, that's good enough. I'll give myself a pat on the back. But rather, to plant within man the desire, the craving, the aspiration for climbing higher and higher. Achekol halal beit midrashon itmalei shifa. Anyone who occupied this house of study in Slobodka was endowed with high aspirations, the highest aspirations. I think I mentioned to you before, one of the students of Rav Nosson Tzvi was Rav Yaakov Ruderman, who later on in his mature life established a great yeshiva. He came to Slobodka as a child. He was 14 years old. They never let in a 14-year-old into the yeshiva. And at the age of 15, he took upon himself to study within 1 year the entire Shas. His father died halfway through the year when he was about 14 and a half. On his 15th birthday, he made a siyum on Shas. The only one in the yeshiva who knew that his father had passed on was the Alter of Slobodka, but he concealed the information from him. And when it came time for Rav Yaakov Ruderman to say to find out that his, you know, to be notified about the death of his father, it became clear to him that Rav Nosson Tzvi, the Alter of Slobodka, had concealed the information from him. And he says to him, Rebbe, I didn't say Kaddish for my father. So the Alter said to him, your Shas was more important than all the Kaddishim in the world. Had I told you that your father died, you would have been depressed and you never would have achieved what you achieved. At 15 years old, you finished all of Shas. But think of the aspirations of a young boy in Slobodka Yeshiva. He's not yet 15 years old and he wants to finish Shas. It's like telling a 15-year-old that he should understand all of the mathematics of Einstein at the age of 15. He should know about electromagnets. How is it possible? But this is the generation of greats that were raised by Rav Nosson Tzvi.
So he was an Illui, essentially. Ruderman was an Illui? Is that what it's suggesting?
Correct. All of these that I mentioned to you were all geniuses.
Yeah.
Or close to geniuses. I don't know exactly, you know, if you have an IQ of 170, does that make you a genius? Or you have to have 200? I don't know. But they were all very, very bright fellows. But they lived in a generation where people thought lowly of themselves. And the yeshiva buffer thought, who am I?
So how did Ruderman respond to... Rabbi.
That I don't know. I could just tell you that over the course of years, he appreciated what Rav Nosson did for him.
Okay, I just want to know how this
by concealing this information.
Okay.
There were other cases where Rav Nosson Tzvi concealed information, and sometimes it had a negative response. So, for example, the story is told that Rav Aaron Kotler had a sister who was an absolute genius in mathematics, but she was not religious. And when her brother Rav Aaron Kotler was in the yeshiva in Slobodka, she wrote him letter after letter, come home and study mathematics. He was brighter than she was. She thought that her brother Aaron would be the mathematician of the generation. Why are you wasting your time in yeshiva? Rabbi never got those letters. They were intercepted by Rav Nosson Tzvi, because Rav Nosson Tzvi understood that Rav Aaron was a sensitive soul, and if he would get these letters from his sister, he would begin to plant doubts in his mind about whether he should stay in the yeshiva. And somehow, after 3 years, when his sister was writing him already poisoned pen letters, is this the ethics of your yeshiva? You don't even take the time to respond to my letters? And finally, somehow, I don't know exactly how, don't ask me, Rav Aaron got wind of what was going on. That the altar had prevented him from seeing the mail. And he packed his bags. And he left Slabodka. The entire history of the Torah world would have radically been different if not for the fact that Rav Nosson Tzvi got wind of the fact that Rav Aaron was on his way out. And immediately he ran like the speed of light, an elderly gentleman, to the train. And as the train was pulling out with Rav Aaron on it, the Alta jumped onto the train and spent 3 hours on the train convincing Rav Aaron Kotler to come back to the yeshiva in Slabodka. Hence, we have the largest yeshiva in the world today, the yeshiva in Lakewood, because the Alta in Slabodka was able to jump onto the train. My father told me that his father was not a fan of Slabodka. He was a misnagid to the approach of Slabodka. I never knew my grandfather. He died when my father was just married. He died 9 days after my parents were married. I'm the youngest of five. So I asked my father, why was his father so opposed to Slabodka? So he said the following. He said that the classic lecture of the altar in the yeshiva was the following. The universe is made up of four levels, going higher and higher. What's the word for that in English?
A pyramid.
A pyramid. Excellent. Thank you so much. On the lowest level of the universe is what's called domain. We call it carbon, totally lifeless. Then we get to the next level of the universe, which is called Tzomeach. Those are things that grow from the ground. Then we get to the next level, which is called Chai. That refers to the animal kingdom. And on the fourth level, the top of the pyramid, is the Medaber, man who's endowed with the power of speech. This was well known way before the Alta in Slabodka. And the Alta would say to his students, and he drilled it into them, that there's another level on top of the pyramid. And that's the Ben Torah, the Yeshiva Bacha who studies Torah. He's at the top of the pyramid. And then Rav Aaron would say, and then Rav Nosson Tzvi would say, but on top of the pyramid of the Yeshiva Bachrim is the Slabodka Yeshiva Man. And then my grandfather would add the following. All that they remembered, the students of Slabodka, was that they were on the top. What they didn't remember was what the Alta said after he, at the end of his shmooze. Now that you're on the top, how are you going to behave? That part they omitted. Yeah. All they heard was that they were on top. And basically what my grandfather's critique of Slabodka was that they held so much of themselves. If you ever get a chance to look at the pictures, there are pictures from Slabodka. They didn't wear hats in Slabodka. They wore top hats. This was the way the Alta would teach his students how great they were. Top hats were for very, very fancy people. So the democracy of all are created equal of Kelm did not express itself in Slabodka. On the contrary, in Slabodka, we are like the Superman of our generation. We're the yeshiva man. They weren't yeshiva bachrim, but they were yeshiva man. Mm. A yeshiva man means a Superman. We are on the top of the top. That's what they remembered. Now, if we had time, we would study the opposite of Slabodka, and that's called Nevardik. And he has half a volume on Nevardik, Rabbi Katz, out of his, 5 volumes. In Nevardik, it was just the opposite. To beat oneself down, down, down. And the classic story of a Navardika yeshiva bacha was that he would wait online to buy tickets for a train, and sometimes the line was an hour long. He finally got to the head of the line, or I think the British call it a queue, and when he got up to the front and the woman behind the thing would say, okay, 10 kopekas, he would put his hands into his pocket and see that he didn't have any money in his pocket. And he was absolutely humiliated, but that's what he did deliberately to self-humiliate himself. So that's the exact opposite of Slabodka, because in Rav Nosson Tzvi's philosophy, on the contrary, you are the greatest. You are the superman. You're wearing a top hat. Anyone who learned in Slabodka had to be absolutely spotless. He didn't look like a shlub, you know, with torn clothing or stained or this. He had to look perfectly spiffy. He had to be cool. Because that was the educational philosophy of the altar. Now, amongst the various yeshivas, the spin-offs of Slabodka, one of them, I don't want to mention it by name, because I'm actually recording this, I don't know if this is working or not, I don't know, because it fell and it doesn't have anything on the screen. I'm very frustrated about this. This is my truck. This is like Billum's, you know, donkey, you know, this is serving me for a decade. Yeah. I bought it for $75 a decade ago in Canada. $75 Canadian dollars. Anyway. Yeah, yeah. But now I don't know. Anyway, so the one of these sheaves, I don't want to mention it by name, in Queens, New York, they wear the spiffiest, most designer clothing that you could imagine. And the reason is because of the influence of the Alta Slabodka. You're talking 100 years later. Or the Yeshiva Bachrim, who are not influenced by the Slabodka methodology, look like, you know what I mean? You know, a black suit with a black tie and a shirt that's half white, half dirty, you know what I'm saying? They're not in those yeshivas. Those yeshivas that were influenced by the altar, you had to look absolutely, absolutely spiffy.
You said Rav Soloveitchik studied at Slabodka?
No.
No, okay.
He was in Brisk. There was no Musar in Brisk. Okay. Rav Soloveitchik said that he thinks his grandfather, Rav Chaim Brisker, had he been alive at the time of the altar, he would have had a much more positive feeling about Musar, because what the altar is going to demand, he's going to demand from his students the highest level of creativity and originality. Every student is different, and the greatest quality as an educator of Rav Nosson Tzvi, he was a superman at this. He would know you through and through. He had an uncanny intuition. He could shot you up, he could evaluate you, he could know what your nefesh, what your soul, what your psyche is made of. Yeah. And that's how he was able to raise a generation of greats, because he knew in each case what approach would fit for them. There was no standard approach for everyone. It had to be custom made.
Wasn't that kind of Zissel's Chiddush also, like just the psychoanalytic side of like of...
But not this individuality. That was Rav Nosson Tzvi. In other words, what Rav Nosson Tzvi did was, Slabodka became almost a hub, and many yeshivas were created as offshoots. And anytime there was a possibility of creating a branch or an offshoot, Rav Nosson Tzvi would look around, and he would point his finger and single out so-and-so. He'd say, you're the one who's going to create this new institution. And he sent Rav Aaron Kotler to Kletsk. Again, later Rav Aaron Kotler came to Lakewood and formed the yeshiva there, and he sent this one to be a rabbi here and this one to be a rashiva here, and he knew exactly who you are. He knew how to shots you up, how to evaluate you, and which derech, which approach is fitting for you. Everything was about originality. In Kelm, we were all equal. You know, there was one derech, and we all had to live under that discipline. All right, I realize it's getting late. So if you want to continue with this next, then we'll give one more shiur, at least on Rav Nosson Tzvi, if you'd like. So please make a note that we're up to page 120, the word Anshei Haskula. Do you see that? There's the first main paragraph on page 120. Now, if you have one copy that's extra for me, and you could mark off where we're up to, because I don't like to, you know, Jackie, this is your safer, so it's perfectly clean, And I don't like to make markings in the sefer. So if you have an extra copy here, I would take one home and you'll let me know where we go from here. We also had an idea about starting a basic Gemara class. I don't know, did that die away? That withered away with...
On Mondays?
On Mondays, yeah.
That's, we're going to continue.
So we are going to continue. So in theory, we might meet twice a week. In theory. Once on Monday at 6 and once on Wednesday at 6?
I think so.
All right, you'll tell me, Jackie, the ball's in your court. I'm like a Kelmer here. I'm not Slobodka. I'll do whatever you tell me. You know what I'm saying? I'm very, passive. You'll lead the way.
You know what school Rav Avraham Yochanan belongs to in Lakewood? Is it?
Not familiar.
Okay. That's the one who wrote the book that I mentioned, Otzar L'Chaim. It's an older Musar book from like 500 years ago.
And he republished it?
He has an anonymous author. Feldheim republished it. He has a translation of it in English. And it basically deals with Tanakh from like a... and uses that as like a basis for Musar. So it was like one of the first Musar texts that I read. He's in Lakewood. I didn't know what...
If you have do you have access to the book that you can show it to
me? I have it at home, but I know that...
Home in Chutzlar to me, in America.
But I can probably get another... I think it'd be worth getting, you know...
Even if you could print out 5 pages for me, you know, from the internet, if you could get such a thing.
Yeah.
I would try to give you my sense.
Yeah.
But I would tell you this, the Muslim movement today is much more in the line of of Slobodka than it is in the line of Navardik and Kelm and those approaches.
Makes sense.
In most yeshivas today, the goal is to build up a person, tell him how he's like Adam HaRishon, he's like an angel, he has such potential, he's a little less than the divine being himself, and therefore set high goals. If you believe in yourself, if you have self-confidence, all of psychology today believes in self-confidence.
Self-esteem.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that's changed since my youth. Already in my time, I mean, the whole movement of psychology to try to get people more healthy psychologically was to work on self-esteem. But we're going back 120 years ago, you know, to 1880, 1890. And the Alter already sensed in his generation that we got to build up the self-esteem. If man doesn't have a mirror image of himself as someone who's great, then he's not going to set high goals for himself. He's not going to believe in himself. He's got to believe in himself.
Well, it's interesting that there are these parallels that it predates psychoanalytics with Freud and almost like foreshadows it, or if not influences it directly.
I have no doubt in my mind that either indirectly or directly, Rav Salanter, the father of the Muslim movement, influenced Freud.
Yeah.
Okay then, let's take a break.